And good evening, and welcome to Future Focus Now. If it's Tuesday evening, it must be Future Focus. I want to thank all of you out there who've joined us for the past few weeks in some great conversations with individuals who bring you really great conversation, but some great content and great information. Future Focus is here to try to bring you some information. If it's happening today, if it's happening in your life, if it's important in your life, we'll be talking about it here on Future Focus. And I want to thank each and every one of you for being a part of this. What I want you to do is to call your friends and tell them that Future Focus Now is on. As we try to build our base and build our audience, we want to bring it you the best. The last few shows have been incredible. There's some incredible individuals. We've gotten great feedback from individuals about how we're doing. We want to continue down that road. Tonight, I am excited more so than ever before to bring you, I think you will agree with me, a great conversation from one of this country's leading experts in so many areas. There's so many things that I could talk to him about. And I thought about over the weekend, you know, I said, what can you talk about with a person that you've known for 40 years? And what can you talk about that would really get people to understand our guest tonight and to appreciate the amazing individual that he has become? And you think about this. Now, here's a person as an HBCU grad, and we all oftentimes talk about the importance of HBCUs and how they create such a great foundation for folks. Not only is an HBCU grad, but we can throw out universities around the country, very prestigious universities along with that. North Carolina Central University grad, a tremendous HBCU. We can talk about UNC Greensboro, having a connection to there. An individual that has a connection to Duke University. Harvard Medical School, Harvard University, having a connection to NIH. And right now you've figured out who our guest is, because he was the first African-American CEO of the American Psychological Association. And think about that, the world's largest association for psychologists. He led that organization. I'm talking about Dr. Norman Anderson. I want to bring Dr. Norman Anderson in the house tonight from his home in Florida, where he is currently at Florida State University. He is vice president down at Florida State, and also professor of social work at Florida State University after all of that. Norm, welcome to Future Focus Now.
Hello, my chancellor. Great to see you, my good friend.
I wasn't expecting that. All right, let's do it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's great to be here. Great to see you.
Man, I am I'm glad to have you here to really talk about a variety of topics. But first, we got to talk about North Carolina Central. We got to talk about our experiences there, because those were some valuable experiences. But before you say anything, you know, over the weekend, I tweeted out and I had on my Facebook page that I was having you on my show and that you were a graduate of North Carolina Central University. Now, Norm, you know I'm chancellor at Winston-Salem State University. You know this is a Winston-Salem State University show. And so what we want to know is, because I dug a little bit into your background, and I found out that your mother attended TC Teachers College, which is now Winston-Salem State University. So absolutely, what the Rams want to know, wait a minute, what the Rams want to know is how in the world you ended up in North Carolina Central University and your mom graduated from TC.
Oh, man, there's so many answers to that question. But one of them is my father graduated from Johnson C. Smith. So they're saying, well, how did you not get to Charlotte?
We don't care about those Golden Bulls. We just want to know about the Rams. How is it that you did not come to Winston-Salem State University?
Oh, no. Somebody had to head east out of Greensboro. And at that time, I had some friends at North Carolina Central, and frankly, I had the opportunity to play basketball there. I thought I would have that opportunity, and so I headed that way. I headed to North Carolina Central. many of my friends stayed in Greensboro, and went to North Carolina A&T. But I knew an HBCU would be in my future, with my mother graduating from Winston-Salem Teachers College, Winston-Salem State University, my father graduating from Johnson C. Smith, my brother graduating from Shaw. So I knew I would likely attend an HBCU. It was just a matter of picking between so many good choices within like a 150-mile radius of each other in North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because, you know, I'm a big proponent of HBCUs. HBCUs are in my blood. And one of the things I promote, Winston-Salem State University, but I also promote all the HBCUs, because they're so important, that you just talked about, you know, not only, you know, NCCU, WSSU, Fayetteville State, A&T, Shaw. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I'm like you. I mean, that's in my blood, being there. But I am curious if indeed either your mom or your father or mother said anything about you going to North Carolina Central.
No, not really. They left that decision pretty much up to me. But I mean, if they had their druthers, I would have stayed in Greensboro and gone to A&T. My mother dropped some hints about Winston-Salem State University. And frankly, one of my earliest memories in life was going to the CIAA tournament in Greensboro in the early 60s.
Whoa.
With my parents. Yeah, I mean, and watching Earl the Pearl Monroe with Winston-Salem State University.
And you actually got a chance to see him live.
I saw him live, and I saw the stadium going crazy. And I said, why are they going crazy? Because, you know, that time you could smoke cigarettes, and it was just a smoky arena. And you know, when the lights went down, you could see all the smoke around the sides of the audience.
Not manufactured smoke.
This is the real deal smoke. And it was hard to see, because Earl the Pearl was making so many incredible moves. People kept standing up from their seats. They almost stood the whole game, because in anticipation of what he was going to do. So I was 1960, you know, I was 5, 6, 7, you know, years old. So I had to peek around. But yeah, that was that's really one of my earliest memories, is going to those games.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty special to be able to. I didn't realize that you'd actually seen him live. We talk about him a lot, you know, in terms of how the impact that he had on my life as a youngster. And growing up playing basketball, you know, all of us wanted to be like Earl Monroe.
Oh, yes.
With the spin move. That's what it was all about. Yeah. So one of the things, in terms of, I wanted to talk a little bit about your experiences at North Carolina Central University. You were there as a student. You just mentioned that you went there to play basketball. So tell us, in terms of how that worked out for you in terms of basketball scholarship. I'm more interested in also the transition from basketball to really focusing in on academics, because I want to talk to you a little bit about Alonzo Davis in just a minute.
Oh, absolutely. And it was an interesting journey, because frankly, coming out of high school, I was very concerned as to whether I would be accepted into a college or university, because my grades were so bad. You might say I was academically disinterested. It just wasn't the focus. I loved certain classes I had in high school, but excelling academically, despite the fact that my parents both pushed education and had advanced degrees, it just wasn't my thing back then. So I was fortunate to be accepted into Central, but I also played basketball in high school and didn't get any scholarships, but I knew someone who played on the team at Central and thought, well, I'll go and, as they say, walk on and try out for the team without a scholarship. So I went to Central without a scholarship, and I'll never forget this. During tryouts that fall, there were 100 students trying out for the team for one slot, because all the slots were filled with scholarship athletes. There was one slot available, and somehow I was chosen. And it was obviously a real thrill for me to be lucky enough, really, to be chosen. And the coach at that time was, being a Boston Celtic fan, that you're none other than the legendary Sam Jones, you know, Hall of Famer, North Carolina Central graduate, in his first year coming back to the campus as head coach. So I ended up playing under Sam Jones. So that was a remarkable experience. But one of the reasons I value Central so much is it really saved me academically. The professors at NCCU were patient with me. They saw potential in me, and they pulled that out of me. And in fact, we're going to talk about Dr. Davis in a moment, but when I took my first psychology class as a freshman, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I just fell in love with the discipline. I fell in love with the subject matter. And he made classes so exciting. And that was juxtaposed with going to basketball practice twice a day and spending a lot of time in practice, a lot of time in games. And I had to make a decision as to whether I would continue down the basketball route or really focus on my grades, because I decided I wanted to become a psychologist. And then I learned what it took to actually become a psychologist. You have to get a doctorate degree. And it's extremely hard to get in graduate school and to get a PhD in clinical psychology to be accepted into graduate school. So I made a decision to quit playing basketball at the beginning of my sophomore season to devote myself to academics. And I'll never forget that. My last game, all these connections, my last game was at Winston-Salem State. University was the first game of the season, and I told the coach that, you know, that would be my last game. It was at Winston-Salem State. It was a tough decision because, well, you know how you know, the status of athletes are on any campus. You know, it's the camaraderie of the team and just the thrill of that kind of competition. But I had to make a decision about my future to really devote myself to academics.
Yeah. I mean, you made that decision on your own.
Yes.
And how much of that was tied into your experiences with the psychology course?
The psychology course was really the main impetus for me making that decision, because I discovered I wanted to be a psychologist. I wanted to take this as far as I could take it. And people like Dr. Davis and others said, well, this is what it's going to take. And they had, I remember one class, they had a visiting graduate student who was an African-American. I'll never forget this, from the University of Pittsburgh, who's a graduate student. And he came to talk to us about graduate school. And I don't know if you were there for that, but he was talking about just how competitive it was to get in. And then you really had to, they only took top students. And I said, well, yeah, I'm not going to meet those criteria. Spending all my time playing basketball. I'm not going to the NBA. So it was really my experience in psychology that sort of instilled in me the desire to focus on academics. And so therefore was really responsible for my experiences the rest of my life.
Yeah, so one of the things that, you know, and students find out oftentimes that I'm a psychologist, and they get a lot of folks, you know, coming up to me. A lot of students will call me and ask me, you know, what it's like, how do you become a psychologist? And so much of that experience is the people that you meet or the people that have mentored you. And you mentioned Dr. Davis. While you and I, our paths at North Carolina Central overlap a lot, one thing that I missed that you got was to have him as a professor. I did not have Alonzo Davis as a professor when I was at North Carolina Central, but he's certainly one of those legends, one of the first individuals in this country of a few who had a PhD in psychology and then went on to carry on and have a leadership capacity there. those people that you meet along the way are so important to your professional development. Talk a little bit about that, Norm, and how that has impacted your work and how you've used your work, that experience, kind of with the things that you have been involved in.
Well, you know, I have to say that one of the reasons he inspired me so much was because he was such an outstanding lecturer. I mean, as an instructor, he made the subject matter come to life. I mean, I was every class, first of all, I look forward to every class, and I was on the edge of my seat just because of how he structured his lectures and his clear enthusiasm for the subject matter. And, you know, when you're passionate about something and you get in front of a class, it shows. And it's contagious. It's infectious. And so that was one thing. The other thing he did that really maybe tapped into my some latent competitiveness from basketball, certainly competitive with myself, is at the end of every class, he'd have an extra credit exercise. So, you know, we had homework from the previous week. We're supposed to read, you know, chapters and text. And he would ask a question of the class, and whoever got it right got an extra, whatever it was, 5 points. I wanted those 5 points every week. So I read the assignment so I could be ready. And it was kind of like, it's like a reaction time experiment. He'd ask a question, and whatever hand he saw go up first, that who he, so it was like, you not only had to have, it was like Jeopardy. You not only had to have the answer, but you had to respond quickly. And I loved that.
The buzzer.
And I love that. So it just really, for now, really brought out ignited the intellectual juices in me that really lasted me for the rest of my, you know, career.
Yeah. I mean, that was really great. So you decided to go into psychology. Your parents were both ministers and really in Greensboro. And once again, see, I do my homework on these shows, Norm.
Sure
I
just do.
Yeah, I just don't come here, you know, without information and having done my research. Read where your mother, introduced you and said that when people asked her, what did you do? Did you go into the ministry? And she said, ministry, psychology is his ministry. Your mother said that about you. And I read about all of these ministers and psychologists in your family. How did that shape you? And how did you use that, those kind of connections and family experiences?
Well, I mean, yes, that's true. That ministers and psychologists, you know, running the family. And sometimes when I say that, people laugh, and I say, "Well, I guess you needed both of those in your family." But yes, my father was a minister. My mother was a minister. My brother's a minister. We have some extended relatives who are ministers. But we also have, sometimes it's hard to keep track of, about 5 extended family members. Cousins-in-law who are psychologists. So we had those 2 traditions in the family, and most of those folks were in the Northeast at the time, in New York, New England area. And I grew up in North Carolina, so I didn't see them as much, but I knew about them and read some things about them. So that was another thing that encouraged me to look into psychology, because of that, family tradition, but make no mistake about it, there was tremendous pressure also to go into the ministry. But again, my parents were very open-minded, and yes, they were very educated, but also very just generally well-read. So they could easily see the connection between psychology and the ministry, and say they felt it was an equally admirable career path to take. My father, I mean, just looking at his private library, he had all kinds of psychology books there. So this is something he was into.
Yeah, yeah. In your work as a psychologist, how would you describe it And what has been some of the tenets of your work? I know you've kind of been on the behavioral side of psychology, health psychology. How would you describe, if someone asks you, what kind of psychologist are you? What would you tell them?
Well, clearly my degree is in clinical psychology, which is that area that focuses on treatment, psychopathology, mental disorders, and it's on the helping profession side of psychology. So that was a program I was in, and I was initially interested in working with autistic children. Childhood autism was my first love, and in fact, I did my master's thesis in that field. But shortly thereafter, I discovered this field called what's now called health psychology, which is a field of psychology that the short version is sort of the mind-body connection, but it's really the role of psychological, behavioral, social, and cultural factors in what we call physical health disorders like cancer and heart disease and high blood pressure and diabetes. That really captured my imagination. So really, for my last couple of years of graduate school, throughout most of my career, even including my time at NIH and to a certain degree the APA, I was really focused on this mind-body health psychology connection. So when I was a professor at Duke, most of my research was trying to understand the problem of high blood pressure in African Americans. Why is it that we have the highest rates of high blood pressure than almost any group in the world? And did research on how stress affected our cardiovascular systems to maybe increase our risk for hypertension. So, you know, that was the initial path I got on as an academic, is really trying to understand this mind-body behavior connection.
Yeah, and so one of the things you've done is you've kind of integrated that into your work. You've also integrated that into your personal life. Today, we talk a lot about, you know, work and balance, work-life balance. You've kind of been in that space for a while, incorporating, you know, some of these things. Tell us about what you've incorporated in your life to get to a kind of a work-life balance. And I think it's some things that we can use today, even today, some of the things you've been involved in.
Yeah, and to a certain degree, it's really hard to, that term work-life balance we use a lot. And it's really, it's kind of an aspiration, but it's not an endpoint, because you never achieve just this perfect scale balance, but you're aspiring to be well-rounded as much as you can, and not neglect any aspect of your life. And for me, you know, certain things have been fundamental in terms of my development. Exercise, physical fitness has been really important, because it is in part a driver of many other aspects of well-being. If you're not physically well, if your body isn't functioning as it should, it really has a negative effect on your overall well-being. So I wanted to make sure that I always had an exercise regimen. Hadn't always been faithful to that. It hasn't been 100%. But over the last couple of decades, it has been, and it varies. It has varied based on my health level, based on my age. I've changed, you know, over time. We play basketball together a lot in Durham. I don't do that anymore. I do other things. So, I consider it a lifelong passion. And the other thing is having this inward journey, this journey into meditation, spending some time in silence, a practice that actually my father used to talk to me about in a spiritual context. But I became really dedicated to spending some time in quiet, silent meditation, actually as a student in North Carolina Central. And that has been the mainstay of my life since that time.
Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned, basketball. So basketball has been a big part of your exercise regimen. I remember you used to come down to the Y when we used to play basketball at 5:30 a.m. and you would come down and join us occasionally. We could never get you to really be invested in coming every day, but you would show up every now and then. So we appreciate your presence to come down and kind of play with us. But it's really been interesting, basketball. Like when you were at Duke, you were in Society of Behavioral Medicine. And every time that we would have a national convention, you would get together and make sure that we had pickup basketball at the Society of Behavioral Medicine. I thought it was pretty cool. And a lot of people would come out and play pickup basketball.
That was so much fun. Yeah, I started that tradition. I can't remember exactly what year that was. I think it was right around, I was at NIH, it was probably around 96, 97. And it was something we just wanted to try. And I was really surprised by the interest in that. And believe it or not, I attended a Society of Behavioral Medicine meeting last year, and there's a group that continues that. Wow. It's just unbelievable.
Wow. I mean, it's pretty intense games.
Really. Oh, very. I mean,
and a lot of people were good basketball players. Some of them had played basketball in college, and so they were highly competitive. But sports and basketball has been a big part of your regimen in terms of how you see yourself, you know, in the growth that you have. You've incorporated exercise, diet. I know you've written books about longevity, really trying to understand how to live a healthy, long life.
Yes. And, you know, I was reading something, you know, recently, particularly in the context of, you know, COVID-19, and, you know, they had sort of three principles, take care of your body. That is, make sure you're getting some movement in your body, exercise, even if it's moderate every day. Pay attention to your diet. You know, it's very easy to go down that snack food, junk food route when you spend a lot of time at home, but be mindful, you know, of what you're ingesting, including substances like not ingesting excessive alcohol, you know, et cetera. And, you know, the second point, so the first point is take care of your body. The second point is take care of your mind. You know, make sure you're getting good sleep every night. And sleep is something that is very important to me in terms of my functioning during the day. So pay close attention to that.
Is this time okay for you?
This is fine.
we'll be out of here by 9. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay, all right. Good.
That's fine. Then I'll have another hour or so on a week, weeknight.
Right.
But yeah, so, you know, those principles are very important. And I mean, they're really lifestyle habits, but they're for a lifetime, for the entire lifespan. Yes, played a lot of basketball up till age 55 or so. But then with knee surgeries, hip surgeries, needed to transition to something else. So got into just walking. It was a great form of exercise, you know, walking outside, walking on the treadmill. Got to have the right kind of entertainment for that, right. Music. But there's so many ways of keeping the body active that are not strenuous, but get the requisite amount of movement to keep you healthy. So it can be a lifelong endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, and those things are really, really important. There's so many topics I could talk with you about, and we don't have time to get into all of those, but I wanted you to at least give us a kind of a Reader's Digest version or a snapshot of this whole work that you've been doing on kind of mindfulness, meditation, and how that's important for productivity. You know, people a lot of people talk about, I want to be more productive. And some ways of being more productive sometimes is kind of getting this mindfulness. And I had a conversation with you, but kind of before the show, and we talked about being present and being centered. And I mentioned the Michael Jordan piece where the guy said that, you know, people go and they study yoga and they go up into the mountains, and he's never seen anyone as present as Michael Jordan. Give us a thumbnail shot of mindfulness, because there are a couple other topics I want to get into while I have you.
Yes, well, mindfulness, meditation in general has been with a practice of mine since 1975, since my days at Central. And as you described, it is a process that really teaches you how to bring your entire being into the present moment. And you say, well, what does that mean? I'm in the present moment, where your body is in the present moment, but frequently our minds are thinking about yesterday or last week or 20 years ago, frequently worrying about or trying to recreate certain scenes in your head that are long since gone, or our minds are in the future, planning, looking forward to what you're going to do tonight, what you're going to have for dinner, what kind of job are you going to have in 10 years. So yes, our bodies are now, but the practice of mindfulness helps you to bring all of you, your body and your mind, into the present moment. Say, well, okay, what's the big deal with that? Well, research on this, and the research has been fairly extensive in the last 30 years or so, showing all kinds of benefits of this practice of being present in the now, including, you know, lower levels of stress, changes in the structure and function of the brain. So you think, oh, this meditation stuff is very sort of ethereal, it's kind of vague. This practice, this daily practice, literally changes the body in ways that promote health and prevent, and actually help treat a disease. But in terms of productivity, you know, one of the strongest findings with mindfulness is that it helps one increase one's ability to focus, mentally focus and concentrate, to be fully in the now with what you're trying to accomplish. And some of that might help explain some of the success of sports teams like the Chicago Bulls, who, you know, their coach Phil Jackson taught them these techniques to help them be fully focused on the task at hand, not be distracted by things that are less relevant. So concentration, mental focus, clarity are all skills that help one become more productive. And in fact, there was a study done not too long ago that showed that people, they actually had monitors on people when they were at work, and they called them at certain times to ask them, what are you intending to work on, but what are you actually doing? Most of the time they were off task. They said, my intention is to write this report, but I'm actually surfing the web right now, or I was actually thinking about something I have to do after work. So they were as much off task as they were on task. But one of the interesting findings with that study is that the more off task they were, the less happy they were overall. So, you know, we talk a lot about multitasking, which is really a myth. You're really switching from one task to another. You can't really do two tasks at once, but you can switch a lot, and we call it multitasking. It actually leads to less productivity. It also leads to lower levels of psychological and emotional well-being.
Yeah, I just wanted you to hit on that, because I know that's some of the work that you're doing. I can't have you on the show without talking about what is it like being a CEO. And the reason why I want to talk to you a little bit about this is there's a lot of data, a lot of information, a lot of surveys now saying that being a CEO is one of the more difficult tasks around. I know you I talk about, you know, you being a CEO, you talk about me being a chancellor, and I always tell you how easy it is being a chancellor. No, I don't. I never say that. You have never heard me say that. But if you think about, running large organizations, and talk to me a little bit about what it takes to be a CEO and what's needed today, in your opinion, more so than ever before, about that role.
Well, I've been asked that question over years in different ways. And I think many of us have assumptions about what it takes to be a CEO and what the job really is, whether it's not just a CEO, but one who is has the so-called top job within any type of institution, whether it's an association, whether it's a university, a corporation, a nonprofit, whoever is in that top seat, it's an incredible responsibility. And some believe it's a position where you are making all the decisions and telling people what to do. Certainly there are CEOs and organization leaders like that, but the task of a CEO is actually to be in service of the people with whom you work. You know, the stereotype is the person is in the top job and everyone is serving that person. Everyone is at that person's beck and call. Everyone's trying to make that person look good. In fact, ideally it should be just the opposite. In that top position, it is less about you and more about facilitating the work of others. Because as your organization goes from a couple of people to five people to 10 people, the less possible it is for the top person, the CEO, the chancellor, the president, to do everything for a well-functioning organization. You have to have people who fulfill these roles. And your job or my job, you know, as a CEO, it is to facilitate their work, to clear the barriers for them to be effective, because their success is the organization's success. And therefore, their success is also your success as a CEO.
You know, but it seems to be a certain amount of loneliness that's associated with being a CEO or being a chancellor or president of a company. And so where do CEOs go to get support and to have the kinds of conversations that they need in order to get better?
Well, there are a variety of avenues for that. Certainly one's colleagues who do the same type of work are a great resource. And I'm sure you've discovered that with your colleagues who are presidents and chancellors of universities. It's a ready-made support group, if you will, of people who understand the challenges and the trials and tribulations of leading large organizations. So it's available, and certainly family can be a great sounding board. Because you're right, it does get lonely, because on the job, there's not that many people you can talk to about the challenges you are having, because you're the only one in that seat.
Yeah.
And that's really one of the fundamental differences, is the lack of people who are on that same job line in the organization where you work. You're one of those people, and there's only one person on that level.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now at Florida State.
I'm doing a variety of things at Florida State, and really I'm fulfilling some dreams I've had for a long time in terms of work, because I was in organizational leadership positions for a couple of decades, and always wanted to be involved in developing other leaders as one goal. You know, another goal is to actually help leaders through some of the challenges they have on the job by using things like mindfulness and emotional intelligence. So at Florida State, I was brought in to, in my wearing my assistant vice president's hat, to develop their first faculty leadership development program, to really spend time working with department chairs, associate deans, center directors, on leadership development. Because universities, like many organizations, people rise to leadership positions because they've done really great work as professors. I mean, they're top researchers, great instructors. Their colleagues want them to, say, become department chair. But frequently, there's not training in leadership. There's training in the nuts and bolts, like, well, how do you do a budget? How do you lead a faculty meeting? How do you hire faculty? But the focus of the leadership program that I created and run is really on how do they see themselves as leaders? How do they define themselves? And frankly, what do they do as leaders? What approach can they take to actually leading as opposed to just doing the nuts and bolts of the job? So the signature program within that larger leadership development program is a one-year class, actually, for department chairs and associate deans. So we meet every other week, beginning September through April. Wow. And there's a curriculum, beginning with something called the Five Practices of Exemplary Leadership. It's an evidence-based model, right, of leadership development. But they get intensive training in mindfulness, meditation, all year long training in emotional intelligence, character development, issues and inclusion and diversity. It's like, how does their own self-identity relate to how they lead others who might be different from them. So we've done 3 years of this program. We added a similar program for emerging leaders, people at the sort of associate, new full professor level, and the evaluations have been great, and it's a lot of fun. There's great people who've been involved in this.
Right. I mean, that sounds exciting because I actually think leadership is so important. Without giving away any company secrets, that had to be a part of the overall vision that either the leadership or the president or someone had about Florida State. I mean, to have a position, you know, that central to the working and that high up in the hierarchy, was that the case? And how has that been articulated to the people at Florida State?
Well, I think it was an evolution for the university that I think that there were discussions before I got there about needing to do more. You know, one of the people I report to, one of the many people I report to at Florida State, is the vice president for faculty development, Janet Kistner. And so Janet had some things in her portfolio that were somewhat related to this. So my coming on was just a natural extension of some of the things that were already happening. And she essentially said, go for it. Design it from scratch and just, you know, create it and make it happen. So I spent, you know, my first semester there learning in the university, meeting with a lot of faculty and administrators, talking about this vision and making it really a shared vision from the president, you know, on down. So there's tremendous excitement about this. There was a hunger, and that's the other thing. There was an institutional readiness for this. It didn't take a lot of convincing. They had talked about the need for something like this, and you know, I came along at the right time with an interest in making it my one of the main things I did for the university. So it was a perfect match from the beginning.
I mean, great work, exciting work. I think that's so important in higher education today. And I believe in leadership. I think that with great leaders, you can change the world, you can transform society. So I appreciate the work that you do. I want to talk a little bit about, we don't have much time left, but Norm, I began this show talking about all the amazing things that you've done kind of in your life, all the amazing positions that you've had. One of the more accomplished individuals that I know, and one of the more accomplished individuals in this country. And you look back at your life, and you and I have shared a lot of different kinds of experiences, one of which was taking care of our parents. And I read, once again, doing my homework, when someone asked you what one of your proudest moments or one of the things you really felt good about was having to take care of your mom when she had cancer. You know a little bit about my story in terms of having to take care of disabled parents for over 20 years. That goes a long way to shaping people and shaping individuals. Talk about your proudest, you know, moment, both personally and professionally, if you would do that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And really the story you just told about my mother is probably, by far, the proudest moment. For me, she developed cancer in the late 1980s, and living in Greensboro, unfortunately, at the time I was a Duke, so it was very easy for me to get home frequently. And in fact, during the final months of her life, I essentially moved in back home, and fortunate enough that I had the kind of job that allowed me that flexibility, and realizing that's a real blessing. Most people don't have that kind of flexibility, but being a professor, I was able to do that, and really got to know my mother better during that time than ever. And in fact, we started a tradition of, I wanted to record her life story. She was raised in Harlem, New York. And lived during the Depression, and very poor in Harlem. And I wanted her to tell her life story. So we used to take long drives in her car, and I gave her a little handheld recorder. And I would ask questions and just let her record, just talk, just record, which actually resulted in digitize those cassettes, and they're actually in the UNC Historical Society's archives. Actually, a lot of my parents' memorabilia and papers and documents are at UNC. I was able to. We had a caregiver at the house, but I was able to spend a lot of time with her, and was with her the morning she died. And so that was really one of the most remarkable experiences of my life, personally. Professionally, my entire career has been a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. Because given where I started academically, and so everything I've done has been a gift to me that I haven't taken for granted, and I always want to see how I can make a contribution to the institution where I was working. And so one thing just occurred to me, just thinking about a couple of the leadership roles at the National Institutes of Health, at the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research at the National Institutes of Health. I was the first director of that office. And then being the first African-American CEO of American Psychological Association. In both cases, the person who followed me in those positions was African American. Mm. We don't often get opportunities to have positions like that. Right. I like to think that my work with those institutions helped open some doors, for other people to follow who are African American, so I was very proud of those two legacies, if you will.
Great stories. I mean, thanks for sharing that. How much did you know about TC from your mother?
I was very young, but my mother was an all-out ram. It was just before I knew really a lot about the university, all I knew is my mother kept talking about this, TC, TC. Then what is that? But I later learned, yes, that's Winston-Salem State, that's Big House Gaines, that's Earl of Pearl Monroe, that's just so many luminaries. I mean, Winston-Salem State was just really a part of my world growing up. And I remember my mother, she was an adult student. She went back to school, later in her 40s. Hmm. And I remember her studying her coursework and having to get to class, and later went to seminary at John Wesley College in North Carolina and got a degree, and actually ended up getting an honorary doctorate degree from there as well. But yes, I remember a lot of cheers for TC in the house.
Yeah, that's great. And I know that you are an Eagle. And I know you still stay connected to North Carolina Central University. Tell us how you stay connected, how you tried to impact North Carolina Central University since you left.
Well, I mean, I always try to make homecoming as much as possible. But beyond that, I talked about how important the university was for my intellectual and personal development, and I always wanted to be in a position where I could somehow give back to the university. And there are many ways of doing that. One way is that I've established a scholarship fund for students at NCCU through your old college, where you were dean, the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences, just to provide that support that so many of students at North Carolina Central need financially to get through. And I add to it every year, and even talking to psychology about potentially doing some things for them as well. But that's one of the ways that I think is really important, that we all of us who graduated from HBCUs to really think about using some of our treasure, even if it's just a limited amount, back to the universities, because they perform such an important function in society. And there are just so many examples of students who perhaps would not have had the opportunity to go to college if it weren't for the presence of HBCUs. And I know for me, at least, Central made a tremendous difference in my life.
And we appreciate that. And oftentimes you, wherever you have been, you've always acknowledged North Carolina Central University. And not everyone who has had the kind of life that you've lived, had the kind of positions, sometimes people forget, forget their first institution. You've not done that. I appreciate that. Man, we're out of time.
It went fast.
We've covered so many topics. I appreciate you. You've been so generous with your time and to come on Future Focus. And at some point, I know the work that you're doing now has certainly is inspirational to me in so many ways. And you talked about the leadership book, and my executive team would tell you that they have that book. And that is because of having conversations with you about the importance of leadership. So not only do we have to have you on Future, you have now been on Future Focus, we're gonna have to have you on campus to do some work as well.
Absolutely, I'd love to. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, so it's gonna be great. Once again, man, thank you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Great to see you. Keep up the great work, Chancellor. You're doing a wonderful job.
I love when you call me Chancellor like that. You usually call me another name, but we won't say that. No, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Norman Anderson has been our guest tonight on Future Focus Now. An extraordinary interview, great information, great conversation. We'll be back next week with another great conversation. And this time, Maria Howell. Maria Howell is a graduate of Winston-Salem State University, actress, singer, extraordinaire. We know her from The Color Purple. We'll get her on next week and have a great conversation with her. And if we're lucky, I might be able to get her to sing something. Maria, if you're listening, I might want you to sing next week. So thank you, everybody. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week on Future Focus Now.